Good evening. My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here. I was here at the first roundup 14 years ago. I know it's the 15th roundup, but it was only 14 years ago. How do you figure that? Because you see, the first one, there's no year. The second one is 1 year. Oh, never mind. I was sitting there thinking, you know, I'm kind of a sentimentalist. Most of my career I've tried to hide it, but I'm just a big pussycat, I guess, underneath. And I was thinking tonight, if I had 1 day left to live, someone told me I had 1 day left to live, I think I'd like to come down here to this convention and take part in your raffle. Laugh if you want to. It would make that last day seem like forever. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to see my old friend Bill Roop, who's always ahead of me. As long as he's in the room, I can grumble about the old-timers. When he's not here, I have to defend them. Glad to see my friend George, who moved from Georgia out to California 25 years ago and fell to my clutches. Now he's moved back here, but I haven't released him yet. And a lot of old friends and a lot of new friends, and it's very nice to be here. This has been a great weekend. I think we've had some wonderful speakers. Just one, I've enjoyed all the speakers very much. Bill last night with that down home North Carolina. Well, we're just old country folks. You just want to put your hand on your wallet and back out of the room. And Mary Pearl, I did not hear Mary Pearl today because John took me to some restaurant called the Vittles over here. And we ate in time, but it was a long time getting to the serum afterwards, too. So I didn't get back in time, but I'll listen to your tape on the freeway, and if I find any mistakes, I'll call you. Although it's kind of fun releasing an Al-Anon. Yeah. And Billy this afternoon, such a fine talk. He really was a rotten kid. But he gave a fine talk and certainly doing well. And I'm sure tomorrow morning we'll hear another fine talk. But I was listening to these talks. It's kind of interesting. I know there's a lot of new people here tonight. Who are all you girls? Here's how. I must be losing it. Now I at my age, in my late 70s, I still like to go to the single bars in Hollywood. And I come up to pretty girls and I smile and I say, "Hi there. Do I come here often?" But I know there's a lot of new people in the room, and I'm sure that it's always kind of overpowering. Incidentally, the new girl that won the book, we kind of hate seeing girls 3 days sober looking better than our 46-year-old speaker. You know, at least have a black eye or a torn shirt or something. When I was your age, I was in the nut house. But I know a lot of new people here. You wonder what all this is about. I used to sit and be baffled by it when I was new and had a difficult time. And we all, you know, I was thinking about the three speakers. We all seemed to had our first drink about when we were, I guess Billy was 14 and Bill and I were 15. And we maybe had sips of beer before that, but that's when we had our first meaningful drink. And we had completely variegated histories after that. I mean, nothing at all similar. Nothing similar before that. Nothing similar after that. And here we are in this room today, and we all are extremely similar, as we are similar to you in a way that you do not as yet understand. Because we tell you, you know, that you're amongst people who are just like you, and you can look around, no, how the hell can I be that? I'm different shapes and colors and sizes, and they all have a different story. You will never hear your story exactly in this room. They've all got different variations of it. And you may wonder what the hell it's all about. And you may, I would address, I would call to your attention a part of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that I must have heard read 50 times and read maybe 25 times before it finally hit me after I was sober some time. My God, that's my story right there. And it's the story of all the people I seem to sponsor, and it's the story of everybody I know. And it talks about people like us. You know, one thing you want to remember, because it's kind of, we don't talk about it much, but there seem to be types of alcoholics. Nobody, this isn't in writing anywhere, but there seems to be a type of alcoholic that's an alcoholic by any measurement you give, and something happens that really threatens their security. They lose a family, lose a job, somebody dies, something, and they're overcome and they quit, and they never drink again. And there's all kinds of, you hear that, you'll be referred to such people when you're people complaining about your drinking. Why can't you be like Fred? He used to drink and he stopped. Then the same type of people, if they have become physically addicted as well as psychologically addicted, and physical addiction to alcoholism doesn't seem like much, but I'll tell you, it's much more lethal than physical addiction to drugs. Withdrawal is much more deadly in alcoholic addiction. But they are the people for whom the treatment centers were originally created, to medically withdraw these people step by step. And as they do that, they point out at each step of the way what has become of their life, and they quit. In fact, there's a hospital in Seattle called Schick Shadel that advertises, "We can cure your alcoholism in 30 days. And they do, and they have a long list of names of people who are alcoholics and no longer drink and have never drank. But then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by their measurement, and something happens to really threaten their security. Maybe they lose a family or lose a home or somebody dies, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And the same type of person come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks, and they mean what they say. I've had enough. And they quit. And they always drink again. And these are the type of people that have baffled society for 5,000 years in writing, you know, baffled people. One time they thought they must be possessed by devils. They'd put them to death, they'd flog them and send them away and send them out of the country, all sorts of things. And up to this day, there's still all kinds of people like that around us. And it's they baffled science, they baffled medicine, and they baffled religion, and they baffled social workers. But I'll tell you, if you're like me, where you would have a personal experience with it, is watching the face of somebody who loves you when they say, "Oh, how could you? You were doing so well, and you promised, and the children were feeling good, and here you are. How could you do that?" And there's no known answer to that except, "Get away and leave me alone." Because I don't know what the answer is, because I can't understand it either. But this is the type of alcoholic that meets in rooms like this. The kind of the funny thing about it, nearly every alcoholic in this room has at one time thought they were the other type of alcoholic. And we have passed the entrance examinations. And we have come here. These are the type of people in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill Wilson didn't know about types of alcoholics. He knew there were different types. He didn't know who they were. But again and again, he says, alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics of our type are the people who don't stay sober. Those are alcoholics of our type. And all of us seem to have that in common. But in this book, if you read chapter 3, if you're new, the big book is significant for one reason. It's terminally dull. When I first came to AA years ago, my new sponsor had me read the book. And I read it, and I thought, Jesus, you know, they say it's a badly written book. It isn't a badly written book. I'm a professional writer. I said, all right. But it's just dull. Just dull. Some years later, when I came off Skid Row, and went back to AA, and my new sponsor had me read this book, and this time, you know what I found out? Just dull. Endlessly dull. I mean, I write things to get action. Buy this product. Take this action. Send it to that. Bah, yep, bah. And I'm used to calls to action. And you read that book, and if you are thorough about this stage of your demand. So you don't, Don't worry if you're new. It's a dull book. I think about it. It shapes up as you go along. It gets smarter every year. But in chapter 3, it talks a little bit about what alcoholics of our type seem to have in common. If you're in this room, you probably have it too. Somewhere along the line, all of us have voluntarily or involuntarily had to accept the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And it says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursued into the gates of insanity and death. And it goes on and talks about how we struggle against that term alcoholic. Why? I guess because that would indicate we couldn't drink. Then he talks about occasional brief recoveries. We've all had those. Oh, thank God, it's getting better. I got under control. Followed always by still worse relapse. Boom. None of us would be here if we hadn't had the relapses. Then it gets to that delicious little phrase, reaching a stage of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I used to think, God, that's how drunk you get. But that's not. That's wrong. That's how you feel after you sober up again and people are demanding reasons for your actions. And pitiful and incomprehensible. That gives a little paragraph of funny little things people like us do. We talked about it earlier. The other speakers have. Changing from one kind of drink to another. Like the book says, from scotch to brandy. Could be from anything to anything. Or was said, drinking beer only. Our speakers have mentioned that. Or drinking wine only. Or reading spiritual literature, or taking physical exercise, or going on trips, or not taking grips, or going to hospitals or sanitariums, all sorts of things. It says we could increase the list ad infinitum, which means forever. And that's true. And people around us wonder, what the hell is wrong with us? Why did we do that? What are you doing all these things for to keep your ability to drink when it's eating your lunch? You know, what the hell's wrong with you? And the correct answer to that is, screw you. It gets a lot of the rationales out of the way. And the odd thing is, we all come here. One of the great things we have in common when we come here, probably the single most common thing I know amongst people like us, we come here knowing that my case really is different. And that's what kills people like us. You know, when I was a little boy, there wasn't any Alcoholics Anonymous yet born. Wasn't born until I was, what, maybe 8 years old? And then it wasn't very much for a long, long time. Just took off maybe in the mid-40s, 50s, 60s. And you'd think it'd been here all along, but it really hasn't. But it's expanded. In 1945, 35, for the sake of argument, there were two at least prominent alcoholics of our type who got together and started this thing. They didn't know they were starting this thing. They're trying to keep each other sober. Later on, developed into AA. But now it's in 134 countries. There's millions, more than 2 million sober alcoholics. Nothing to it. Dr. Jung, who treated the first guy here, said, the only answer to alcoholics is a spiritual experience. And in fact, when Bill wrote this book in 1938 and published it in 1939, the 12th step was written different than it is in the current books. He said, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these in all our affairs. And the members of his group said, Bill, what the hell is that about? You're the only one that had a spiritual experience. You didn't have them as a result of these steps. You had them in the town's hospital. You didn't even know what was going on. How could we have a... We're staying sober. We haven't had a spiritual experience. And they really had to think about that. The book sold so slowly, they had plenty of time to examine it. But they finally got a whimsical taste of something that we now believe pretty much to be true. But they didn't know it then, but they had a hint of it. That's this. That in some way that no one can describe, and no one really can analyze, these 12 steps, when taken in the context of a group effort under the guidance of 12 traditions, do something that nothing else has ever done in the history of mankind for alcoholics of our type. It brings about an incremental spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson got his. Boom! But the way we get ours. You want me to make amends to that bitch? And somehow, little by little, it brings about the same effect. People with a spiritual experience who don't even know they've had a spiritual experience. So that's why in the next printing of the book, they wouldn't change the 12 steps to what it reads today, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps. And it's quite simple, and there's no reason to think we all, any of us have to die drunk or die insane, nothing. There's only one small cloud in the sky, really. And that is, according to the most reasonable records of the National Institute of Health, when they discuss alcoholics of our type, it is estimated in America, where AA is really hot, I mean, there's Alcoholics Anonymous, any town's got a stop sign, it's got a Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And that really is true. I mean, I'm not going to mention this, but when I got off the plane and no one here to greet me this weekend, it was an honest mistake. Why didn't I look in the coffee shop? I know he was waiting for that shoe to drop. I wanted to get it out of the way early. Yeah. So it was not his fault. He was in the Atlanta airport. There's a big, we come off the train and then you come up the steps and you wait there for people. And there's one little series of gates that's over here called the T gates. And you just walk in and you walk over to the, you don't ever go by there. And he waited there for 3 hours. I just rented a car and said, to hell with him. So, but I got to Atlanta. I was glad there was a number to call. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. They referred me to the Rebos Club. It's an answering service, apparently. Your AA office here on Peachtree Street is an answering service. Is that true?
No.
Well, she said it was. Anyway, and the Rebos Club gave me directions how to get here. But I mean, there's AA everywhere. So it's always kind of a shock to realize that, according to their figures, something maybe a little more than 95% of alcoholics of our type in America still die drunk, or as a direct result of drinking. Many people in this room will die drunk. Maybe me, maybe you, I don't know. It sounds very negative, but it's not because AA doesn't work. It's because people allow themselves to go back to feeling their case is different. The man who taught me that and pounded into my head some years later, I thought he was giving me a recruiting talk. Some years later, he got upset with the things that were happening, and he stopped going to AA, and eventually went to a psychiatrist who gave him some medications and made him forget why he didn't drink, and he drank himself and died drunk. And people said to me, God, you know, you're not doing very well yourself. I said, how are you going to do with your sponsor getting drunk? And I said, that just proves what he told me was right. It proves what he told me if you don't do these things. Because there's a big, again, to new people, I don't want to get off this, but Dr. Silkworth, who was Bill Wilson's doctor. In 1945, he started the Grapevine, trying to hold AA together a little bit. That was before they had the tradition. And one of the first articles was written by Dr. Silkworth, one of the very few, as far as I know, ever written by a non-alcoholic. And he said, you alcoholics make such a big deal about your slips. He said, as though some sort of celestial punishment or something. He said, that's not that at all. We see it in medicine all the time. We find someone with a severe heart condition. They come to us. We help them. We get them on their feet. We get them going again. We give them a regime to follow. You eat these foods. You don't eat these foods. You take walks. You get some sleep and so on. And they flourish. But as they start doing better and feel better, it gets a little boring. Like Billy talked about this afternoon, you get too busy or whatever it might be, but I don't really need all of that. I don't take my walk, I'm doing well, and certainly wouldn't hurt to eat this a little bit, and on and on. And they never go over to here. We go just a little, huh? No, I'm doing fine. God, it's really appreciate. One day you're over here, and down you go, and you're dead. Said same thing with diabetics. Come to us, they're in dreadful shape. We get them, or I guess he mentioned, diabetics, and we We take care of them, and they give them. They flourish. We give them a regime to follow. You must not eat your sweet sugar. You take your insulin shots every day. And that time they didn't. Also, I could get it was in shots. You get sleep. You get rest. You do these things. Eat these foods or anything, and they flourish. But after a while, they get a little boring. God, I've been doing well for 3 years now. I can't imagine a piece of cake going to hurt me, and it doesn't. Just gets them over there. And I don't think I need all that rest. And little by little, one thing after another, one day they're over there and they're down. So that's all that happens to alcoholics. There's no celestial punishment. They follow the regime and they do very well. But after a while, it gets inconvenient sometimes. I don't think I need to do all those meetings. You know, I may have my phone on list that these people are bothering me at home and I should be doing what? Now, that sounds a little odd, doesn't it? Bill Wilson had his phone number listed. Chuck Chamberlain had his phone number listed. I got mine listed in 5 directories. And everybody that I know that's a good AA seems to... It's only when you're a big shot, I guess, you have an unlisted number. But there's some people do. That's all right. I wasn't going to call them anyway. To hell with them. But little by little, they stop doing the things. They get away from things. And eventually, one day, down they go. They say, oh, he must have done something terrible. No, he didn't do anything terrible at all. He just stopped doing the things that keep people sober. Because this is not an acute illness like pneumonia, where you're very sick and then you get over it. This is a chronic illness like diabetes, where you get very sick and you get over it, but then you have to take care of yourself, or else you get sick again. And that's really why we get together. In our meetings, we have two reasons, I suppose, to get the real reason for meetings. One is to show new people there actually are people who are staying sober, who are like them. And secondly, to help remind ourselves of what happens to people who don't go to meetings. And that's exactly why we're here. But what do we have in common, these speakers today? We all drank. We all got something out of it. When I was 15, I didn't grow up in the Southern Baptist Church. I grew up in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Our dropouts become Southern Baptist ministers. I don't know if you ever heard of Norwegian Lutherans. They never get down here. They never got to Wisconsin. A few years ago, I was talking in the convention in Oslo. God was pleased to be there and see you. And they took me up to where my grandfather and his brothers had come from in the 1880s. A whole migration had left Norway in the 1880s and came to America to get out of that damn climate. And they all settled in North Dakota and Minnesota and Wisconsin. And they spent the rest of their natural life saying, Jesus is cold here too. Yeah. But one of the reasons I believe the Norwegian Lutheran Church is so strict is because they brought the Norwegian Lutheran Church circa 1886 to America. And in Norway, it liberalized, but it didn't here. They kept it at 1886. That's the rules they remembered. You know, people in Norwegian Lutherans, even if they're married for 30 years, would never make love standing up. Just in the fear that some passerby would think they were dancing. It's a tough church. But I grew up in a very strong Norwegian Lutheran, in a very structured church, and I did very well. My parents were good people, and I could read fast. I was shoved ahead in school a year and a half or so. Now they're supposed to send me to progressive schools, but then they shoved you ahead until you got to your reading level. I was much smaller, but getting along. And I was catechized and confirmed and had a very structured life. And I didn't know the structured life. That's the only thing I knew was that Norwegian Lutheran Church. The only, you know, we knew about God. I've been hearing people say things like, I've been searching for God for 30 years. I never searched for God for 10 seconds. He slowly circles the Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners. And he gives it to Catholics. Which was always right with me till I became one and married the other. Anyway. But now here's something. I never talked about this much, but I thought about it recently. My parents got divorced when I was 12 years old. That means nothing. Everybody's parents gets divorced, seems like. But can you imagine this? I have never heard of a divorce at the age of 12. Nobody, I never heard of one. It never had happened. And so my parents, it seemed to me my father deserted us, and he hadn't, but I didn't know it then. And I immediately did the worst thing that anybody can do, although I didn't know it, just my natural flair for screw-up. I began playing my mother against my father to avoid discipline and structure. My mother gave me hell and run to my father. My father gave me hell and run to my mother. They both gave me hell and run to my grandma. And I fooled them again and again and again. I just made fools of them. By the time I was 15, I was flunking out of high school. I was feeling bad all the time. I didn't have any friends. I didn't like anybody. I hated my parents. Just everything was just terrible. And I don't know what the hell would have happened to me. Because I, without structure, I'd dissemble. And what saved me, the war started. Not much of it seems odd, does it? But I'd go to some movies and I'd see John Wayne kill Japs and things like that. And I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll go over in the Pacific and get the Marine Corps. And I told my mother's going to Superior, Wisconsin to visit my aunt. She packed my little bag and gave me $15 for the bus fare. And I hitchhiked to San Francisco. I had never hitchhiked. I stood outside of Minneapolis. A guy gave me a ride to Minneapolis. I said, how do you get to San Francisco? He said, it's down that way. Some guy stops. Where are you going, kid? I says, been San Francisco. He says, so am I. Hop in. He's in the Navy going back to his ship. And he just, for days, he drove me and listened to me prattle. He must, I'd like to meet him someday. He must be a saint, you know. And he'd buy my meals at night. He'd get, there weren't any motels, but get a trailer court. He'd get me a bed. And I didn't think anything about it. I thought, I never hitchhiked before. I thought, you tell people where you want to go, and they take you there. That's all I do. I told him I wanted to go in the Marine Corps and kill Japs. He said, I think you're a little small. I was about this tall and I had a face full of pimples. He said, I'll tell you what you might do, kid. Try to get in the Merchant Marine because they're crying for people. They can get almost anybody warm. All their good guys go in the Navy. I'll drop you off at the Coast Guard office at Market Street. Go in there and good luck to you, kid. And, thanks. He said, I want to be in the Merchant Marine. I said, all right, fill out this application. And he had told me, put down 60 and don't put 50. That'll be a kiss of death. So you're only 16, kid. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And they issued me Seaman's papers right there. Temporary, but followed somebody to the National Maritime Union where I signed a waiver for my dues. I didn't know what that meant at all. Somebody else took us to the Embarcadero. That afternoon I was a ship on my way to the South Pacific. And it really was fun for about an hour. That's where the World's Fair was last year. That's Alcatraz. That's the Golden Gate Bridge. And that's the end of it. There's nothing out there. And I was shoved into a room with three of the worst type of people that any small, skinny, pimply-faced Norwegian Lutheran kid can be with. And these people are called men. What the hell are you supposed to be? I told them a joke that I was used to go over good in study hall. Didn't go over good there. Why'd you get in your bunk and shut up? And I lay in my bunk. Of course, that ship, I never had that kind of feeling before moving. It seemed hot in there. And these three guys were talking. And I almost died. I'd made some mistakes. I wasn't a very good Lutheran kid compared to Lutherans, but I was really pretty good compared to anybody else. And these guys turned out to be sinners. Oh, shoot. They'd been in San Francisco for several days, and they were talking about what they'd been doing sexually primarily. And I just, oh, God. I don't want to give the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. These guys were doing it with people. I couldn't believe my ears. Then I realized, of course, they've all got black hair. Those are the Catholics I've heard about. But I eventually found a niche on that ship. I became the ship fool, finally. Hey, kid, get out of the engine room. Dump me into the left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up on the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease. And they would sit around and drink every day. They all had whiskey in their sea bags. They shouldn't have had them, but they had them. And they all, and I'd watch these people. I'd never been in a room with a bottle of whiskey before. And it just shocked me terribly. And one day, one of these guys turned to me and says, "How about you, Junior? You think you're mad enough for a little snort?" And right there, I drew the line. I might be dumb, and I might be small, and I might be inadequate, but I'm a Lutheran. And I was preparing something to tell him. I was going to say, "You get that whiskey out of my face. I have to be a Norwegian Lutheran. I guess you don't know what that is, but you'll find out someday. And I promised my mother and grandmother I'd never drink, and I never will. And I don't want you to try to intimidate me to drink that anymore. Get it out of my face." I was just going to tell him that. I knew it would just make him turn white. He says, "Why do you think you're mad enough?" And I heard this voice say, "Goddamn right." A little weak under pressure, too. So I had my first drink out of the first bottle I was ever close to. Went down my throat, my stomach, my throat, my mouth, his shirt, finally. But all the way across the Central Pacific, when nobody was around, at least once a day, I'd go into these guys' sea bags and take a drink of that whiskey. And I hated it, and I'd throw it up, I'd have to wipe it up. But I wanted so desperately, I thought if I held a drink down, they'll think I'm a man, which was ridiculous, but I didn't know it then. We were just coming into Pearl Harbor finally. They're still digging up ships. And I'm down there at night before my 16th birthday. I'm taking a drink of that crap, and it stayed down. And it stayed down. And then I couldn't breathe. Then all of a sudden something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. Didn't think much about it. When you're in your teens, you learn things like that. You know, I never had any insights. I always envied people in AA with insights. Heard a guy say, "When I held that first drink down, I knew I'd gone into a new garden of experience with many flowers and fruits to be savored for several years until the fruits became sour in my heart. And I had to come to this wonderful pro," you know. Oh, man. All I ever knew is if you can hold it down and you can breathe, it makes you feel better. That's what I learned. And the next day they took me to Honolulu and bought me 3 or 4 bottles of beer, and I got drunk. They thought it was funny. I thought it was funny. And that's the, I didn't become a terrible, ravenous alcoholic. And later on, I was on another ship in the Aleutians, and I was in the Navy at the end of the war. I was in the Naval Hospital of the California, being sewed together from the Naval. And I took some tests, and I did very well in tests, so I he gave me an honorary high school diploma from the Military Institute. And I went back to Wisconsin after the war, and you went to the University of Wisconsin, won some trophies for the university. Met this lovely girl, dark, flashing eyes, and black, lovely hair, something I've never seen before. And she won my heart. And she said, "I'm a Catholic." I thought, I can't take her home. What can I do with her? But we got married, and I went out in the world. I became a sports writer, still my favorite job I've ever had in the world. Then my wife began manifesting the habit patterns of Catholics that I didn't know about. And no Lutheran knows about them. But if you're a little Lutheran boy or a Southern Baptist and you marry a Catholic, you're about to have a big family, bunkie. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. I remember saying to her, "Can't we use birth control?" "No." But I don't know what I'd have done if she had said yes. It's hard to realize in this day and age that in those days people didn't talk about such things. I'd been overseas in a war. I'd been through a major university. I was around. I was pretty slick. And probably the only word at the time I ever heard the word condom was in a Navy training film where they showed this voluptuous girl and explained what would happen to you if you did not use a condom. And at that stage of my life, I wouldn't care what happened to me. What you would find in those days, in the 1950 example, kind of bad kids would say things like, "I got a rubber." And even they would be ashamed to buy them. You have to get someone depraved to go in and buy them. And they would be ashamed. They say, "Give me a pack of cigarettes.
And some rubbers."
Now look how much progress we've made over the last 55 years. Drugs over at my house, kids come in, say things like, "Hey, give me a package of condoms
and some cigarettes." Yeah.
Try to get better jobs, and I had a lot of kids, and I'd be on advertising and public relations, working in corporations. In all these years, I drank and raised hell, because that's what World War II veterans thought we should do. Some of us did. And I'll tell you, I've heard this said before, I'll say one more time. Alcohol is the best friend I've ever had. It did something for me. I can see it in retrospect. At the time, I never had any insights at all, as I did. But in retrospect, what alcohol did for me on that ship is the same thing it did for me all those years in one form or another. That's the only thing I ever found that take a guy like me full of holes and make me feel the way men look. Just like that. Boom. And I love it. I can do things when I'm drinking. I can carry off conversations. I can be a suave person. I can do a lot of things. The only problem I have is I have a tendency to drink too much sometimes. Or as my psychiatrist pointed out to me, I have many times been thoughtlessly overserved. And when I drink too much, I act bizarrely. And some people said, they got this new thing in town called AA. Why don't you go to there? So I went to my first AA meeting in 1949. A long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born, were you? We love you. And I didn't expect about 7 or 8 old guys, fat guys, sitting around a table, and they looked at me, and I thought I was back in that ship. They said, "What the hell are you doing here, kid?" I didn't realize that. I was 20 years younger than anybody else in AA in that state. I was in my early 20s, and I said, "I don't know, they suggested I come here." He said, "You think you're an alcoholic?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "What the hell do you think's wrong with you?" And I tried to be honest. I said, "I think I'm too sensitive." "Listen to this, LeMoyne. He's too sensitive." Yeah. I never said that again for a long time, I'll tell you that. But I went to AA for a little while, but I mean, these guys are old drunks. I'm not an old drunk. I have a tendency to drink too much. And I went to a big corporation out of the state, an advertising department. I went there and I got in a little trouble drinking because I drank too much. And I discovered something. I went to the human resources. I said, "You know, they got this new thing called AA, and no one knew much about it." And I said, "How about if I go there a couple of weeks, see if I can get my feet on the ground?" "Oh, yeah, because you got a lot of potential, Clancy. You do that. And if nothing else, it'll give you a couple of weeks to look for a new job." And you could go home and say to your charming bride, I've gone back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Wonderful, wonderful. What do they want you to do, honey?" They want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for anybody, anywhere. "No, they don't. They are, yes, she wants to stop entirely. We have the same sense. We know about that. I release you, you son of a bitch." But I knew I had a lot of emotional problems. I have sensitivities. I feel inadequate, I feel different, I feel there's something missing in me a lot, and I found that alcohol filled it up. But when you're sober, you've got to do something about it. So I had spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to try to get to the root of my problems. I read books, I did a lot of things, but nothing has ever been quite as helpful as a few drinks. And I went up and down, and I'd go down and come back up against that, a good resume, and boom, up and down. I finally went down in Dallas and didn't come back up. Couldn't believe it. I was working for one of the biggest companies in America, and I was doing very well, but I guess I wasn't. And they fired me, and they notified my wife before I was fired, so when I came home from work, they were gone. She'd taken the children and left, moved away. They took my car away, took everything. I went from being a big executive in a big office to standing on a street corner with my clothes in a bag, and I was hot with that Texas State Hospital. I knew they were going to get me back to give me some more shock treatments. I didn't want that. So I got a guy friend gave me a ride. He said, "Drive my car to Los Angeles." I said, "Okay." I got as far as El Paso. where I used to be on the faculty of the university. A lot of friends went to Juarez, drank. Oh, God, that was fun. Got back in my car the next morning, went up to Phoenix, got drunk, lost the car, never did find it. All my clothes, all my ID, everything. Got in a fight that night with a guy in the street corner trying to be a cop. He threw me in jail overnight. In the middle of the night, it was very hot, but 130 in that Phoenix jail. And I threw up. It turned out to be a guy's bunk. I thought it was a toilet. And he wasn't there, but I laid down by his bunk and rested my cheeks on the cool tile, and he came back from where he was. Found this drunken guy in front of his bunk, and his bunk full of vomit. He said, "You damn drunken bastard!" And he kicked my front teeth down my throat. Yeah. That was one of the few days I was really glad I'd been in psychoanalysis. I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. Okay. This son of a bitch is overreacting. But I didn't want to say anything and make trouble. And the next day I went over to the AA club and got out of there, didn't know anybody, hustled some lady for $20, got to Los Angeles, found a guy I'd given a start to, he gave me some money, I got drunk on that. He wouldn't give me any more. He said, I called Dallas, you had a car accident like you told me, you're a bum. And a couple of days later, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission and said, stay out of here, you stinking mooch. I tried to explain to him, I'm not a mooch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the L.C. and Elmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and the New Yorker, Serving Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside that mission on a cold, rainy morning, about like it was this morning. A cold, rainy, except it was warm, rainy morning this morning. And I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what it was. I know what it is now, but I'm sure other people in this room have had it. When you suddenly realize there is no friendly direction. There's no place to go back to. No one's going to be glad to see you no matter where you go. That is really depressing. And I knew I had to get off the street. I thought maybe I could hustle my way into some AA club. That's the only place you can go. Torn clothes and vomit on my shirt and blood and my no front teeth and disheveled and unshaven. And I found there was an AA club at the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax. The guy says, go up this hill to Hill Street and walk over to the lake. Walk over hill to Wilshire and walk west. And I did that. I found in my car, the 72 long blocks. God, it was raining and I was sick and I felt so bad. I remember walking up Wilshire Boulevard, this fancy boulevard in Los Angeles, people going by in cars and pointing at me and laughing. And I think, if you only knew, I'm not like this. And I got to this AA club. Same old crap. Same old. Admit your problem is alcohol. Turn it over to God. Live and let live. Welcome home. Ha 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 ha. Because I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. If you're new tonight, you already know what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's for alcoholics. Alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol, and they get in a lot of trouble. They come to AA, admit their problem is alcohol. Once they do that, they return to God and live better. And I don't fit in either one of those. My problem is not alcohol. I wish to hell it was. I wish it was. I wish I were one of those people who stopped drinking and things turned out. My problem has always been these alcoholics say, I just can't quit. I can quit anytime. I've done it so many times. My problem is after I quit, in a day or two or three or four, somebody seems to sneak into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next morning when I get up, they start to tighten it. And it manifests itself as just a little growing restlessness. Just a little irritability. Just a little tired of taking sermons from people who I'm supporting and companies who I'm making look good to give me your damn sermons. Maybe if you got off my back, I'd be better. And try to do what's right and get along. And I've tried a lot of things to cut that feeling, but nothing cuts that feeling like two or three drinks. That's all. That's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. But then sometimes I drink too much. And they say, see, your problem was alcohol, wasn't it? You have to say, yeah, I guess it was. You were right. But inside you just want to shriek, but you don't understand. It's not my problem. People like you are my problem. Everything, all these things are my problem. And even if I were an alcoholic, I could not return to God. There may be people here who can return to God, but I can't. As Bill quoted me so well as saying, thanks, Bill. But Hitler said, if you give me their minds till they're 12, not 7, 12. Jesus. I guess up in North Carolina, they don't, what's all numbers in it? Give me their minds till they're 12, and a little part of them will be Nazis as long as they live. But that's the same way when you've been, like Bill was in his church and my church, and there's a little bit of that. You know that you're bad. You discuss to hell with yourself. There's no God. You know, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. But sometimes you wake up at 2 in the morning and you're going to go to hell. Say all you want, or you're going to go to hell. Remember once in El Paso, we were so cute. Another guy and I had this deal all set up to put a personalized ad in the paper. A dial of prayer for atheists. They'd dial his number and no one would ever answer. We hugged ourselves. Some rotten snitch in the bar blew the whistle on us, but almost. Another one of our great ads we did get in, Spanish maid with dog looking for new position. But that's... you got to remember, we were hip and slick and cool. But anyway, I can't return to God. Because my church, you break 3 or 4 commandments and you're in danger. You break 5 commandments, it's pretty bad. And by the time I got to walk to AA this time, I've broken 10. 10 out of 10. Some of them were accidental, but I broke them all. And the Norwegian Lutheran God does not accept people who have broken 10 commandments. So I'd want to hear this. All these years I've been going to AA off and on. Not sit there, except I kind of liked it until I got into this God stuff or the religion. And I was beginning, I believe you. I don't want to hear that God shouting. And here I'm in an AA club, and it's so sick. And at night it was still raining. At a meeting, I ate about 4 pounds of cake because I could chew that. And at a meeting on gratitude, I almost puked. I thought, oh, Jesus. The next day, there was a Sunday morning. And that night, there was no place to sleep. It was raining. Everybody got home. I said to the manager of the club, I tried to put on my newcomer look. I said, I'm a newcomer. I'm looking for sobriety on an all-time basis. And I have no place to stay. Can you help me? He said, you're lucky, kid. A guy named Joe Quinn left an old 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. And it's dry, but it doesn't run, but you can sleep in it. How's that? You want me to sleep in the abandoned car? Said, yeah, good deal, huh? Yeah, that really is nice. Thank you very much. I still remember being there that night. I was so sick and cold, and my mouth was bleeding. And oh God, I felt so bad. And I get up in the morning. It was Sunday morning. Now I go and have some cake, and they have a spiritual meeting. They talk about Jesus or God or somebody. And it kept raining. And I lurked around the club. The next night there was a meeting, and I went to that. And I went back to the abandoned car. It just kept raining. And I never dreamed that'd be my sobriety day. Because I really wanted to stop drinking sometimes, and I never could. And this, I didn't want to stop at all. They said, your only desire to stop drinking. I had no desire to stop drinking, because to me, stopping drinking is insanity. I'll tell you when I stopped drinking. I was in jail one night overnight. I was in jail several times overnight. I'm no big felon. I'm not like Billy Noonan. Went to jail for months. Oh, Jesus. But I would go to jail because I get to a certain stage of my drinking sometimes where I find it essential to counsel police officers. I got to tell them what I think of their lousy fascist ways and what rotten bastards they are. I come out of jail one morning. I'd done it several times. I'd go to home, take a shower, and go to work. You know, I had it knocked. He said, guy, you should have stayed home last night because your little son died and we couldn't find you. And I almost went crazy because I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy. He was the newest one, and he died. And I couldn't bear it. I could not bear it. I still remember the weekend sitting with my wife's father and her two brothers, all big, healthy farmer guys up in Wisconsin. Went up there, and these brothers said, "Oh, here, Clancy, it's been tough on you. Have some more coffee. Have some pastry." And very nice. But in their eyes, you could just see, "You dirty bastard. You dirty bastard. Look what you've done to our sister. You dirty bastard. But here, have some more coffee." And the next day, we had a funeral. When nobody's around, I put my hand in his casket. I said, "John Emsland, this will never happen again. I promise you. I promise you my life." And I went back to work in Texas and got along pretty good for a while. And then I started drinking a little bit and started to get a little out of hand. And I have to remember, no, I'm not going to ever do this again. So I stopped drinking for my dead baby son. And got along fine. My kids and I started having fun together, and I liked my job. And it's like Easter. Somebody died, but there's a reason for it, and you're going to live happily. And it really was wonderful. Except somebody one night snuck into my room and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day they start to tighten it. And then it started again. Restlessness and irritability. And then the thought joined my mind, the worst of all. This stinking God killed my little son, who's never done a bad thing in his life, to punish me because I'm a sinner. What kind of a dirty, rotten son of a bitch God would do that? And I just, whatever affection I ever had for God, "You're going to punish me someday, but you're not. I don't. Till then, you can go screw." And so it's mounting, and I need. And all of a sudden, I found myself getting edgy and tense. And the job I didn't like much anymore. My daughters, who I'm doing it for, they're noisy. "Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. For God's sake, we'll play tomorrow." And hate myself for being like that. And just it mounts and mounts. And I couldn't stand it. If I could only have two or three drinks, but I couldn't. My wife took the kids to Mass one morning, and I parked the car in the garage, took the hose and the exhaust pipe, and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. And then the guy next door happened to be watching through the window having a cup of coffee. Well, he didn't come out of there. The motor's running. So I ambled over there, and he found me dead in the car. He pulled me out, and they beat my chest, breathed my mouth, rushed me to the hospital, determined I was severely mentally ill, and committed me to the state insane asylum. Now, that's what I get with prolonged sobriety. That is not an alcohol problem. That's some kind of terrible problem inside of me that I don't know what to do about. But I don't want to stop drinking. When it gets bad, I got to have something. Now, I often wondered, what the world could have enabled me to stop drinking? I'll tell you as far as I know, as far as I can determine. In some of the meetings in that club, there was a movie actor who went to the meetings. And that impressed me. My God, a movie actor. I'd seen him in the movies. I found a lady who was just a second-rate character actor. Wasn't much for you. But I'd seen him in the movies. And I thought, God, movie actors got a lot of money and a lot of prestige. Maybe we could share his fame and fortune. And then I stayed sober a few days. I was leaving that car. It just kept raining. And then the old-timer starts, "If you want to stay around the club, you got to get a sponsor." So I went to this movie actor. I said, "Bob, would you be my sponsor?" He said, "Sure, kid. I want you to do what I tell you." "Oh, sure, Bob." And they said he wasn't a very good actor. He really was, because he acted nice in the meetings, and that took a lot of acting for him, I'll tell you. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort. Just, "Do this, do that." I think, why am I taking this crap from this guy? Because he was my meal ticket out of there, that's why. And I found out later he didn't like me. And I don't blame him at all. I don't want to brag, but I was the worst type of newcomer there is in the world. And because I know that, because I've had people like me to sponsor, and I just want to kill every one of the little bastards. I'll tell you who they are. People who've been around AA a long time, know all about it, and continue to drink. Because everything you tell them, Yeah, I know that. I used to tell Bob things like, he'd explain to me for 20 minutes about something. I'd say, that's really interesting, Bob, but I think you misquoted the book, didn't you? Made him crazy. Well, but he tried to help me. And somewhere along the line, I'll speed this up a little. Somewhere along the line, I heard him say something either to somebody or to me, to the effect of, Don't ever think your problem is alcohol or you might die drunk. What the hell is that now? What new breakthrough is this? The Screen Actors Guild. I said, Bob, what the hell does that mean? He said, that means that if your problem is alcohol, you don't need AA. Oh, is that so, Bob? You need a retake, is that it? Or maybe a SAG card? What do you need, Bob? Shut up, he explained. He gave me a long explanation of it, to the effect that the problem is not alcohol, it's something called alcoholism. I said, oh, man, Bob, don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm very smart. Alcoholism, huh? He said, listen. And he talked to me, must have off and on for two or three days, different times. And it's all gone to the wind now, but I know it impressed me at the time. But the one sentence that stuck with me that I've used many times with other new people, to come to understand, if my problem is alcohol, I don't need Alcoholics Anonymous. What I need is to say, I quit, and get my life shaped up, and live happily ever after. All those people can do that. However, if I suffer from this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, physically fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, that's exactly how it's been in my life. I've stopped and you feel bad. I thought I was the only one. I said, well, if that's the case, why do people drink? We're doing all these bad things to them. He said, get this out of your head, kid. We don't drink because it's doing bad things for us. Just the opposite. Of the 8 or 9% of drinkers who are alcoholics of our type, he said, our hallmark is what alcohol does. It does something special for us that it doesn't do for most people. He said, when I drink, it almost instantly alters my perception of reality. When I drink, it almost instantly changes my relationship to the world around me. It almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening to me. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He says, because it isn't real, it's only happening in your head, you dunce. And it sets up this phenomenon of craving as well. Our hats are off to you, pal. Sets up this phenomenon of craving as well. He said, nobody understands that. And nobody ever has to explain that. We talked about it this weekend. Just compulsion to drink. Why? And it never has been an explanation. I have an explanation that I think fits me and may fit somebody else, but I know it fits me. Is that when I'm in desperate straits and I drink and it brings me to where I want to be, from black and white to color in a sense, as soon as I get there, I start to sag a little bit. I instinctively take more drinks to hold it. And you keep drinking to hold it without even being aware of it. You can see guys so drunk they can't walk and they're crying out for drink. Why? They're trying to hold that. And eventually you get so drunk you can't. You get sober again. But I said, Jesus, Bob, that's happened to me a lot. Then after you're sober again and you know it's so terrible for you, why do people drink? He said, that's the other aspect of it again. And a guy gave me a talk, tape of a talk a couple years ago that I'd given when I was 3 years sober. And I talked about something I haven't talked about for 30 years, but I've been talking about it ever since because I remembered what he said. He had a concept that is hinted at in the book, but I believe to be absolutely true. He said, kid, when people grow up, people are born, they grow up, they have to learn to deal with things. You learn the things that are problems, you learn with conflicts, situations, good things, things that are apparently good but really bad, things that look bad but they're really good. You learn to deal with people, you learn all these things. He said, that process is called maturing. And when you become a mature individual, you live pretty comfortably. You don't get into bad situations, no big things. They're just, you know how to handle things. You pay your bills, you do the things, you take care of your kids, you on and on. It's pretty good. He said, but this almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He said, because on the way, when we run into conflicts we can't handle or situations that are too painful, I drink. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. I just go on. But you don't realize you're filling your closet full of unsolved emotions. So all of a sudden, now you're going to stay sober in AA. And I would have never guessed this in 10,000 years on my own. Here I am. I'm sober. My mind is clear. I'm an adult. I've got a good brain. I've got abilities. I can write well. I've got verbal skills. I'm strong. I'm a fairly good athlete. And never once guessing that all of this is at the intermittent beck and call of childish emotions. We call them alcoholic emotions. It sounds a little more gratifying that way. Oh, I guess that's my alcoholism. What are alcoholic emotions? I love you. I hate you. I'm going to run away. Let's get married. If you want to see alcoholic emotions, stop by a schoolyard some morning. Mine. He says, and eventually it gets so painful, you got to get some relief. And there's only one quick relief. That's to have a few drinks. So you drink till you have to get sober. Then you stay sober till you have to drink. In fact, some doctors say people like us can get to a point where we at times have to drink to preserve our sanity. And then you drink till you have to get sober. You stay sober, you have to drink. And every time back and forth, your brain says, but you see, you're not really an alcoholic. It wasn't really the alcohol. It's all these other things people don't understand. And he told me, I said, Jesus, Bob, that's the story of my life. I've been doing that and doing that and never understood why. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh. What is it, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. And I thought, my God, I'm an alcoholic. For 10 years, I've thrown away every opportunity I've had. I've had great opportunities, big corporations, people love me, just all sorts of things. And here I am sleeping in the back seat of an abandoned car without any front teeth. I said, Jesus, Bob, why doesn't AA explain it the way you do? Instead of all this allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind, all this double talk. He says, it does, kid. I'm there on the wall. He says, you have to admit you're having some problem with alcohol. It's called step one. We're having a problem with alcohol. Then there's a dash, which means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And you're also having problems without alcohol. That was January of 1959, a long time ago. And I've really never had a severe desire to drink since then. Not because my life turned out well, because my early sobriety was terrible. Because I still had a bad attitude, mouth, sarcastic, nasty mouth. And people hate to take crap from people without teeth, I'll tell you. And I got fired after jobs and things. But I'll tell you what happened. My sponsor always made me go to work and get jobs, and even if I lost them. And he would try to help me with my emotions. And one of the greatest things that ever happened in that my life happened there, and I didn't know until I looked back years later. I gradually began to suspect, this guy knows how I feel, which doesn't sound like much, except I'd never met anybody who knew how I felt. They always say, I know how you feel, but oh, you don't either, for Christ's sake. But he did. And I think, what's the big deal about that? Well, I'll tell you the big deal about that is this. Because all of us in this room, all alcoholics, have had enough advice to last us 10,000 years. You know, passers-by give us advice. Here's what I think you ought to do. You just brush it off. But if you find someone who you believe knows how you feel, that advice becomes meaningful information. And you may take actions that you never would have taken for your father or your boss or for nobody. And that's the greatest gift you can get. If God would give me the power to give you one gift, I hope you find someone that you come to believe knows how you feel, because it will change your life. The only problem is then, if you have a sponsor, if there's one of these mean sponsors, they ask you to do stupid things. Stupid, stupid, stupid things. And now they don't actually ask you this, but it sounds like this. See that wall back there? Yes, of course I do. That's bright green. You're kidding, aren't you, Bob? I tell you, it's bright green. It looks brown to me, Bob. Well, goddammit, you act like it's green. Now, they don't tell you the color of walls, but they tell you things equally stupid. I don't care how it looks to you. You called that woman a bitch, you apologize. She is a bitch, Bob. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girls to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize.
Sorry.
Bitch. I don't care how it looks to you. You stay on that job. But Jesus, Bob. They got me stuffing envelopes for $1.09 an hour. I used to have an office bigger than this company, for Christ's sake. This is just so bad. So I don't care. You stay on that job till you get a better one. Someone told me you weren't at the Friday night meeting.
Well, Bob, it's a big clique is what it is. There's the in-group, and they all suck around each other, and they go to parties. Now, let's have coffee. Don't tell Clancy. We're going to go...
He said, well, maybe they're right. You go to the meeting. And this goes on and on and on. And one day you turn around and the damn wall is green. And then you have to spend the rest of your natural life dealing with dumbbells who think it's brown. But eventually I was able to hold a job. And after 5 years, I was director of advertising, big medical corporation, doing well. Got radio and television, did a lot of things. But in that early, I want to go through this quickly, because I know there are people like me here, I'm sure I've wasted so much time really explaining things. But they start on me. By the time I take the steps, isn't it? Bob, I can't return to God. I just can't return to God, Bob. I'd like to, and I can say I will, but I won't. He says, it doesn't say you return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob. Does that fool the other boys and girls? He said, no, it doesn't say that, you smart little shit. He said, read it. Because you come to believe, we came to believe in something. You never return to anything because you're coming out of sickness. You're coming into the sunshine. You come to believe. Can't you believe in God? I said, no, Bob, I can't. For reasons of my own, I cannot believe in God. He said, can't you believe in AA? I said, well, part of it is nice, but it's mostly religious sometimes. These old timers, they make it bad. He says, do you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are, Bob. He says, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And he became my higher power. He could not send me to hell. He tried, but he couldn't. But about this time I started believing, he knew I felt, and I was doing things that were just amazing. And I thought about that later. You know, if you're new... That step is a dangerous step because you think you're going to return to God. Then what are you going to do? It's going to restore you to sanity. What is sanity? You can read 10 textbooks on mental health and you'll find 10 different definitions of sanity. Oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. Psychosis. It's kind of oversimplified. But when the brain is under sufficient conflict and cannot find a resolution in order to maintain its neural integrity, it may change the perception of reality to resolve the conflict. That's called psychosis. Sometimes if it's all over, you're really crazy and you're put away. But sometimes just a rifle, just a little bit. That's for these people who say, God, he was a good neighbor for 20 years. All of a sudden he took a rifle and started shooting people. Something triggered that particular thing. Now here's the funny thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Cases of alcoholics becoming psychotic are never. Yeah. Well, that's ridiculous. They say this is the number two cause of insanity. It is, but not from psychosis. Alcoholic insanity is a different thing entirely. That's more of a physical condition. I'm sure most of you have never seen a case of it. But when you're drunk, as we all come off drunks, with a terrible, sometimes you You got to put the fire out. Get some cold and wet in you. You get very thirsty because alcohol, of all things, this fluid dries out your body. Who would imagine it? It kills the cells in the body. Kills dozens and thousands of cells. And when you add fluids, the cells come back to life. There's only two organs in the body that when cells die, they never revive. The liver, the brain. And we know what happens in the liver. But in the brain, over a long period of time, it takes a long time sometimes, but you kill enough brain cells. And you get a dried out brain. The irony is we call it a wet brain. It's called the Korsakoff syndrome. Most of you have never seen a case of it. I see it all the time, and I wish to hell I didn't. But a guy with an alcoholic brain, he's not out there acting crazy. He's sitting on the bed, and they come and change his diapers and feed him and put him to bed and get him up and change his diapers and feed him and change his diapers and feed him and put him to bed and get him up. And they can never get better. They stay like that. Their body's healthy. They stay like that for 40 years. Their families come down and see if dad or mother knows them. Who are you? Get away. They cry and go home. That's alcoholic insanity. That's something that is beyond belief sad. Now, why don't alcoholics become psychotic then? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, they drink alcohol, which alters their perception of reality. I never guessed I can induce temporary psychosis. And it comes back to normal tomorrow. And this is so... I had to come to believe... Over the years, some of my beliefs have changed, become a little more sophisticated. But if you're struggling, let me just put it this way. We're asking you to believe there's some power here. You don't have to know what the power is or how it's going to do it. Remember that. You don't have to remember, have to know how it's going to do it or why. It's just going to do it, or else this room wouldn't be full of people. This power will somehow enable you to live in sustained reality without having to induce psychosis to stand it, either alcoholically or by pills or other chemicals. And it, you don't have to know how it's going to happen. I never, but I came to believe it happened because I believed the people who were telling me. And when you do that, you've taken the second step. Later on, you may have more sophisticated versions of it. But isn't that a great simple? I can't drink. I can't stay sober. I got to try to come to believe there's something here that will enable me to be able to live in the world without having to drink. And then the last part of that trilogy, of course, is the third step, where they talk about turning your will and your life over to the care of God, as you understand, which sounds spooky. So I had to take a little more simplified version of it. Do what they tell you. Do what that old guy tells me. And then as a result of that, little by little, I stayed sober. Now you may wonder, I spent too much time on the first three steps. I've got all those other nine steps. I'm not going to discuss them. But to me, those three steps are the root of sobriety. When people get drunk, they've gotten away from those three steps. They've forgotten that they cannot stay sober on their own. They forget there's a power here, and they forget to surrender to it. Anytime you're having a bad time, it's a good time to just stop and think, I can't drink and I can't stay sober. There's a power here. I know it. God, I've gotten away from it. And I'm going to do what they tell you. And then my look gets better. And I eventually got to be quite successful. And my wife and children moved back when I was 5 years sober, and they heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Texas. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. It was a little boy, so my job was done. Now they're all grown up. Three of my daughters are turning 16 this year in AA. My son is not an alcoholic. His wife, who's been an Al-Anon 3 years, thinks he is, but he doesn't. That's so sad, because I've been quite successful in sponsoring people and helping people. And it's just so goddamn aggravating. You can't help your own son. The best I can do is stay away from him, because he cannot see me as now. He has to see me as his father. That's great many A's have tried to help their parents or their loved ones. Or you just can't be a good example and wish them well. Only one of my kids has turned out bad. You hate to talk about these things, but... my oldest daughter became a judge. We had so wanted a defense more. No defense attorney in our family. She comes home at Christmas. She says, Daddy, remember the weird little girl she used to send us to our room? I said, sure, honey. She says, when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I see that silly girl that was jogging here. They found her at Albuquerque. Better get out of there, honey. She's there. But the net result is, you know, we've heard a lot of stories. We'll hear another one tomorrow morning from Mickey, a very good story. But we all have varied stories. We all came here with different roadmaps and different histories and different problems and different situations, and yet at a level way down here, exactly the same. The same things work for all divergent people in this room. Because the basic purpose of AA, I believe this with every fiber of my being, the basic purpose of AA is not to stay dry. Christ, Bill Roop and I would burst into flame. The basic purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, new people, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To little by little change my perception of reality. To little by little change my relationship to the world around me. To little by little make me more self-contained and them less frightening. And over a period of time, what happens to you if you do these things, same thing happened to me, I guess. Eventually I came to believe in AA as my higher power. My sponsor died. And I got another sponsor who gave me some confidence. And one night I prayed, and nothing bad happened. And over a period of time, I learned that I was not important enough for God to be angry at. And that he loved me as much as you, no more, no less. And we're all loves us all the same. Or else he doesn't love anybody. And the reason some people around here don't do very well, because they don't take actions that open their head a little bit and let some of God's grace filter in from time to time. So I guess you didn't get the word. This is the sign for applause. This is for muffled choke sobs. But anyway, I've really enjoyed this weekend. I've enjoyed hearing the speakers, and I've enjoyed being with people. Because it all gets down to the same thing. People like you and I have to find a way to change our perception of reality. And then after it's changed, do the things that keep its change. Because it won't stay good. It slides around. You know, no matter how hard you work the program, you never rise above human being. And human beings are fallible, and all of us are. But by God, there's a way to walk with some degree of dignity here. And if you're new, I hope you do it. Thank you. Thank you.